left here one time on a Mesa turn. Old Sparky and Charlie Brakebell, Little Charlie, and Buzzy Rook, Roselle. And when you on the job, you leave here and they give you an order, run extra, bill to Mesa. This order expires at 8:01. It was standard. So we couldn't get over the railroad very well. We got over at Screeton and had then it was time to eat. And the operator from Hazen came over to get us in his car and took us over to Hazen. We ate and went back. And pretty soon the train we was waiting on went by and we took off. Got down there before we got to the depot at Hazen. There was a red signal, train order signal. And I thought, engineer, I said, wonder what in the world that train order signal's down there for, you know. We talked about it and then we were switching around there. So we went on down to the depot and the operator came out and handed up the orders and I looked at it and I told Charlie, I said, our running order ran out 15 minutes ago. And of course the superintendent got a hold of it naturally, the chief dispatcher. And he told the superintendent, Thurston was the superintendent. I didn't know Thurston that well. But he was going to fire us. Well, you know, I have to admit, deservedly so, probably. This is where I get to Tillman. Tillman was local chairman for the brakeman. And we had a man, at the time was a general manager, who used to be a switchman at Biddle. And Tillman, he and Tillman were good friends.
Talking about Mr. Buffalo?
Buffalo. Burl Buffalo. And Timman's working local down south, and Burl was down there at Spartman. He was in depot for something, and the local pulled up there, and Tillman bailed off that caboose and went in there and found Burl and got it cornered. He said, now, Burl, he said, you can't fire these guys. These are all good men. He said, you can't fire them. He said, they can't be too good. They wouldn't have been out there without order. And finally, I think a lot of times they do what Walker wanted to do, just shut him up. Finally, he told Tillman, he said, just don't worry about it. I'll tell the superintendent, give him 20 demerits and let him go. Thurston didn't like it, but they did it. Tillman Walker. Tillman, one of the finest people, I guess, God ever put on this earth. He's local chairman for the brakeman for years. He'd talk your ear.
Let me add a little bit to that. Back in the days when we operated by train orders, you'd go by a red board and they'd have the orders out and you'd reach out and get the orders running 25, 30, 40 miles an hour, depending on what you're on. And you'd get those paper train orders and you might have six or seven train orders that you get up there. And if they had one that was restricting you, they were supposed to stop you there. But like he says, they might have had one where his time would run out in another 15 or 20 minutes, you know, and they wouldn't stop you, you know. And I remember one time we came through Brinkley and old Pappy Henson was the engineer. We was on a steam engine and we got the orders and they always give the head end two sets of orders, engineer and the fireman each had a set of orders. And I looked over, we was running about 25, 30 miles an hour, and I looked over at the engineer after he got his orders, and all I could see was train orders floating in the air. He had let them get away from him, see, and they went out the window everywhere. And naturally, I had mine, and it's always a problem with those train orders, and a lot of them at night. Now, you cannot imagine yourself at night, arm full of orders, and the lights on those engines, steam engines now, were they had a steam-driven generator on that engine that generated electricity for those lights. And a lot of the lights were real dim, and you had to have real good eyesight to read them. So it was a big, big problem back there that day.
Well, you know, talking about train orders, you could get in a rut. You know, a lot of orders, you got them every day. It was same writing. And I was going east one day on something, and when you got to Brinkley, they always gave you an order, 111 has arrived and departed. That was just normal. And so I grabbed the order. We got halfway over to Wheatley and looked. I didn't have an order, 111 has arrived and departed. So I stopped over and called the dispatcher, and I asked him, I said, has 111 arrived and departed Brinkley? He said, yes, it had. I got back on the train. But you get in trouble right quick. We had a crew, when I was local chairman, we had a crew that left here. It was on Saturday, and they were in a big hurry. They were going to go to bauxite, come back. I don't know what. They were going to be do it in a hurry. They had an engine. I think they had an engine 1238, and they gave them their running orders, and it said engine 1328, and they went anyhow. They were in a hurry. We got into it. They called us an investigation, and they had the dispatcher drive all the way down here from El Reno, Oklahoma. But before that, I went into Homer Dyer, and I liked Homer, but he was hard-headed as a damn nail, you know. And Francisco was a fireman. Old Christmas, oh yeah. Francisco was sick. I said, he couldn't be at the investigation. I said, Homer, you can't have this investigation. He said, why? He said, Francisco is sick and he won't be here. He won't be here to testify. Ah, to hell with him. You know, we'll have an investigation anyhow. I said, okay. So this, I can't remember that dispatcher's name. He and his representative drove all the way from El Reno, Oklahoma. And they opened that investigation Dyer did, and the first thing I said, I object to this investigation being held. He said, why? I said, one of the crew members is not here. He's in the hospital. He said, wait a minute. So he went in his office, came back in a minute, said the investigation's postponed. And I told that dispatcher, I'm sorry for this. I tried to get you to stop. I mean, to get him to stop, and he wouldn't do it. But I still liked Homer.
You're talking about train orders. Coming out of Memphis is when he was a headache. You got all a handful of orders at, Kentucky Street, I guess. And you had to read the things, but there you was fighting your way across that Harahan Bridge and down that hill. You had to cross the Frisco. The mop was down there, and it was something else.
Yeah. You know, I come out of Boonville one night with Clyde Charon. Clyde, he's a good old boy, but I could have killed him this night. And we went over to Waveland, headed in, waiting on the local, really. And then we had some time on 991 on further down the road, you know. So we sat there, and finally the local, we had a brand new brakeman. I don't know what he was, who he was, I don't remember. But finally the local, it's middle of the night too, you know. Finally the local went by, and here I got a man on the caboose, conductor, and nobody said a word. And he went and lined up, and I said, well, we'll go over to Belleville for 991, or 51, what do they call it then? So we got out there, and I got to speed up real good, and this brakeman come up there, and he said, Mr. Rose, and I said, what? He said, I think there's a problem. I said, what? He said, you need to look at your train orders. And I looked down at my, I read them real close, and we did not have time to go to Belleville and get in the clear. And Clyde sat over there, and the conductor, and they were all in a hurry. And I told Clyde, I said, I ought to wring your damn neck. He said, didn't you know that? He said, you'll make it. So I called him on the radio and found out they weren't anywhere near, but.
Is your funny thing?
You could have gotten, yeah, and no, it wasn't box signal territory. It's dark railroad.
Yeah.
And it just so happened we headed in over Belleville. I looked out on the highway, and the car looked just like Leroy Williams out there, and I thought, hey, we're all fired. You know, but fortunately it wasn't. But then just, you'd be surprised some of the things that happened that we luckily get by with.
Well, let me add another story. The same thing happened to me. I was with Charlie Cawthorn, and we left Belleville and started over there, and we kept looking at our time, and Charlie asked me, he said, do you think we've got time to make it? And here's what the problem was at that time. You might have engines that would take you over there at the time that you wanted to be over there. At the next trip, you might have the same number of engines, but they wouldn't do what these others was doing. They just wouldn't do it. And I told him, I said, Charlie, we're not going to make it. We can cut off and run a flag over there, or we can back into Belleville and get in the clear. And that's what we did. We backed into Belleville and got in the clear.
Yeah.
But the other alternative would have been to cut off our engines and run a flag over there, or back and get the clear. And we got back out the clear. Now, a lot of them hit it in on other people's times more than once.
Oh yeah, I mean,
hundreds of times that
happened. Yeah.
But that one time out of 100 is whenever you have the problem.
But you don't feel too bad. I mean, you weren't too nervous about it in block signal territory.
Oh.
But west of Perry, there was no block signals from there to Amarillo. And you get kind of nervous when you got into a position like that.
If they had to operate by train orders right now on the UP over here, they'd be out of business.
They wouldn't know what to do.
They would be out of business until they got some of these old heads over here and tell them what they could do.
We headed in one out of Berta, this train we were meeting, and we just barely got in the clear, and I thought, oh my God, this could have been a terrible thing. And he said, this is really railroad. And I thought, no, this is crazy.
I'll tell you a funny story. Me and Jimmy Flippin double-headed the Boonville one time. We were on a steam engine, and the other crew had the diesels. Anyhow, we got up in Boonville, and so we had to deadhead back on the local. It was a steam engine. Of course, it didn't have any radios in. So Jimmy got on. He's a lot smarter than me. He got on the engine. I got on the caboose, which I never did again. I made one ride. But we got over at Danville, and they cut the engine off and went to do some switching, and old Freeman, used to be my neighbor up here, he's dead now, he went back flag, and I was on the caboose, just me and him on the caboose, see? The first time I'd ever been on a caboose. So they called the flag in. I heard him call, and I'm sure he did too, but he's back pretty good ways. And I could see him, and oh, he got about a couple hundred yards away, and they started to move. Snoopy Brightbill. And Freeman said, don't let him go, leave me. And I was standing back there, you know, and he said, pull air. And I said, what are you talking about, pull air? And I found that little whistle. And I tooted that whistle. And it was about to leave it. And finally I figured out, you know, he put that valve down. But he was, old Gallagher, he got left one night up there, round the bluff. In the middle of the night, they went off and left him. But there's funny things happen.
You're talking about this depot. Their depot at Boonville was a beautiful old building when it was built. It was built out of, what it was, stone or rock,
yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah, building.
And they came in there, and the company was in bankruptcy and all that. They were painting it. They put in new doors, which the new doors they put in were not as good as the old doors they took out. And the old depot at Ola, they were refurbishing it, didn't even use it. They were doing some crazy things up there. And the depot is still there. I think it's burned since, but...
What, Boonville?
Yeah, I think so.
I haven't been up there.
Yeah. But it was a nice building. They sandblasted the whole outside of it, and some of the tile roofing that was broken or missing, they went and bought it somewhere, replaced it. They spent a lot of money.
What about the depot in North Little Rock? Have they redone it?
Somebody, I think, has taken it.
I think
the
city took it over, didn't they?
So.
They're making a rec center out, not recreation center, but some kind of a... center.
Well, now the one at Lone Oak, it's been taken over by a historical society or something,
yeah,
and they sort of restored
Women's
it.
Women's City Club or something,
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, all those Lone Oak,
Carlisle,
and Hazen, they've all been taken care of and refurbished.
You talk about Boonville, I'm going to tell you, I may have told you this the first time, but it is hilarious. We was up there one day, and we everybody, in the afternoon, everybody was there, tended to gather around the depot, you know, sitting around there and talking one thing or another. And I was second out, and the crew was first out. I think old Cheatham was the engineer. I don't remember. But anyhow, we were talking about he was going to go out. The train 994 was supposed to come down just west of the depot and cut the engine off, come down to the depot and pick up the crew and then go back. And somebody said something about him stopping up there at the crossing, and about that time I heard the whistle blow, and I said, I don't think he's going to stop at that crossing. I mean, he was moving on, too, you know. And in a minute, I said, he ain't going to stop this depot either. And he went by us. I bet he was going 40 miles an hour. And that brakeman back there, you could just see terror written all over his face. He was scared to death. And I forget that old hog his name. He's drunker than $600. He finally went down and got stopped. And he backed up. And he come by that depot about 25 miles an hour back. When he finally ended up there and he got off the engine with his grip and started in the door. And every time he started in that grip, it hit the door. I can't think of his name, but he was bad.
See, that crew from Oklahoma, and we changed crews there at Boonville into the depot, and they never would stop, or most of them wouldn't stop. They'd just get down real slow, and they'd jump off, and we'd jump on. And, of course, the company never did say anything because it was saving them time and whatever else, I don't know. But old Dick Eller, that's what it was. The crew from Oklahoma was coming through there, and he said, get back, buddy. He said, we're not getting on that thing going that fast. And, of course, they didn't like that either because they had to go down and back up.
There was a time when not stopping but cranking it way down, the crews getting on and off on a flight, but it was a policy. I can remember the Des Moines Division assistant superintendent was always raising Cain, and the brothers were dragging their heels, and rightfully so.
They wouldn't stop?
No, they insisted on keeping the thing moving.
Yeah, right.
You know, cranking way down. But even so, you know, guys trying to get on with their grips or throwing them on and getting off and on is hazardous.
Well, I don't know whether this is right or wrong, but whenever I was the engineer out of Boonville, Conrad was firing for me, and I just shut the engines off most of the time. It's just sort of coast, and they give them a chance to look the train over. You know, they didn't have any reason to be in that big of a hurry. But Conrad was the engineer firing for me, and he'd get on there and open that throttle up, man. He'd get her going for the depot, have the, and then set the brakes. He'd have the smoke flying, sparks flying. And who you can't see anything. And, of course, they were criticizing me because I was too slow out of there. But that's what I would do. I didn't like that speedy departure.
That goes back to the story that the engineer is in control, and you tell them how to do it.
Yeah.
I had one fireman that was fast like that, and I had to pull the air emergency on him about three or four times while he worked with me. The first time I pulled the air on him, we came off of the Harahan Bridge down into Kentucky Street. Now, you've got to remember, there was about six or seven railroads that operated out of Memphis over that.
Up and down what they call Broadway. They call it Broadway.
That was the most congested place you ever saw. And they had these little low pot signals. Well, we come off the bridge, you couldn't see that pot signal over, I'd say, 50 feet from the head of the engine to the pot signal before you could see it. And we come off there, and I told him, I said, slow down, that signal might be red down there. Well, he didn't slow down, and I pulled the air, put it in emergency. And sure enough, that little pot signal was red. We'd have went by it just,
sure.
And yeah, we had a lot of power switches down there we could have run through, see. And usually the best reason for them not doing that is that they couldn't judge their speed sitting on that engine. When you're sitting up high, you don't think you're going as fast as you are if you get down lower. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And I think that their judgment of the speed that they were going was not what it should be, so to speak.
See, I had that one time. I was on the extra board, and I caught Charter Coffin's job on West End, 991. And 994, and he had an old head, it was McQuiston, an old head fireman. I mean, he'd been around for a while, and, you know, like you said, normally you ran halfway and the fireman ran the other half. So going up, it wasn't a great problem. Coming back, I ran to Homewood, and McQuiston ran on in. Well, coming in a bit, and you come downhill, pretty good hill, you know, and he's sailing along there, and I'm sitting over there, and he went past where I would set the brake, you know, and I thought, well, he's fixing to show me something that I've never seen. He'd never seen before. And he went by that block signal down there and started around that last curve, and I said, knock this thing in the head. I said, you're not going to get stopped. And he stopped just till we got to Hot Spring Junction. The signal was ready, the switch engine sitting out there. But Charlie never let him run the engine. And they had some engineers that would not let the fireman run the engine. Oh, I remember Harlan Cox. He let me run the engine one time, and after we got where we were going, he told me what a good job I'd done. He said, how long you been running the engine? I said, that's the first time I ever ran a train. And he liked to die. I thought he was going to have a heart attack.
Let me add the other side of that story. I had an assistant superintendent here at Little Rock come up on the engine at Lone Oak and tell me to stop running the engine and let the engineer run. I was on that Stuttgart local with Lige Snyder, and I was doing all the running, every bit of it. I was even making out our time slips. He was on a vacation, and he came. That was Haunting. It came up there and told me. He said, Howard, I don't want you running this engine all the time. He said, I want Snyder to be running this engine.
I'll tell you about these fish. Thompson. I'm gonna get back to Thompson, whom I didn't like. He didn't like me.
What was his first name?
Bill. He came out of Fort Worth.
Oh, he ended up being a high company official.
I don't think he went any further than road foreman, did, or did he?
No, I don't think he did. Bill, he went Bill, to work
there
for
was another Thompson.
Bill Thompson?
There was
Bill
another Thompson.
Yeah, that was his name.
You're thinking about, I think, but it's not this one. Oh, okay. In fact, he still works. Last time I saw him, he was working for some jackleg outfit out of Hot Springs, that little railroad out of there. But I laid off one time. That's when we had the 10 mile an hour from here to Perry. And this company, officer, you know, they know everything. They'll tell you right quick. And Conrad was a fireman. And Conrad Spear, a good man. I mean, a good engine man.
One of the best.
Well, they left here. Conrad caught the job as engineer. And they left Biddle, and Thompson told him he wanted to run the engine. So Conrad just told him to get over and sit down. Well, they got over and he went west out of Biddle, and he went around a curve and uphill a little bit and then downhill across the mop. And 10 miles an hour. Thompson was going to show him how to do it. Went down there and he said, I'll hold him with the engine brake. He went across that mop, crossed 30 miles an hour. He didn't know, I don't know. He and I just never get along. He got upside me one time. He pulled a test out here at Big Rock on a crew in the daylight, and they used a fusee in the broad open daylight, and it was sunshine, and they got by it.
I was in that investigation.
Sure, we had it out here at Alamo Plaza.
That's right.
And we raked Thompson over the coals. Homer Dyer was holding it, and Homer never said a word. I knew we were doing things that weren't allowable, and Homer never said a word. He just sat there and kept his mouth shut. But after that, me and Thompson never get along. I remember one time I was delegate to the UTU convention, and I went in, and I told him, I said, I'm going to be delegate to my union convention, and I'd like to take my vacation 2 or 3 weeks or whatever. He can't do that. I said, well, listen, yeah, I can do that. He said, no, you can't. I said, well, I'm going to be off anyhow. I said, I don't care. We got too many people on vacation. So I went in and called the superintendent, it was out in El Reno then at the time. I didn't even know the man. I don't even remember who he was. I told him who it was and what I wanted. And I said, Mr. Thompson won't let me have my vacation. He said, he can't do that. I said, he's doing it. He said, I'll take care of it. The next day, the clerk called me and said, when do you want your vacation? But, you know, it's stuff like that. I remember just before the Rock Island went under, when I was going west, and we headed in at Waveland for something. Me and Charlie Norman, Charlie run the engine, and we were waiting on a train, and there was a section crew on the other side, four or five of them. Well, we just stayed on our side. The train came by. We stayed on our side, and the section crew was on the other side, and Thompson and that knucklehead from El Dorado, whatever the hell his name was, I don't remember.
Oh, yeah.
But they were over there. And they saw what happened, and they come over and they called an investigation because we didn't get off and get on the other side of the train. I mean, there was a lot of harassment going on at the time. But they really, I don't think, I sound terrible, but I don't think they had sense enough to really know how to harass anybody.
Don't sound like it.
Yeah.
Who was that? I was on that yard engine out there coming around there, coming back to the roundhouse or something, and who was that going to Memphis, I guess, with that 1300? We hit. I saw him coming, and I started blowing the whistle, and the yard office and people up there saw what was fixing to happen, and whoever that was on that road engine, the engineer couldn't see me, but Carol was the fireman, I think, and I forget now who the brakeman was, but we hit. Broke every glass in the window in that engine that I was on. Broke all the windows, and that's when Patrick, that old seat, hurt his leg, and I was thinking they was going to hold an investigation over that, but I don't remember
that, whether they ever did or not. Well, that's the reason I'm laughing. I was hossing out there. We're on Sunday, and foreman told me to go in there and get an engine out of the house and put it somewhere I don't know where. So I went in there and hopped up on the engine, though, and started up and got it started and lined the turntable up. Started out there and got on the turntable and set the brake. Didn't have no brake. So put the train, I knocked it in the head. That didn't do no good either. And went off the end of the turntable. And they had to call the hook. I went home. They never did have an investigation. I don't know why. They cut the brakes out of the truck. That's the way you learn lessons. I never got on another engine. I didn't look to see if the brakes weren't working before I got on.
Well, they told you that when you went hostling.
Yeah.
What
yeah.
to look for.
That happened several times.
Well, old Charlie Turner, you know, he went through the end of the roundhouse.
Yeah, made a new door.
He went in the roundhouse, and he didn't get stopped, and he made a new hole right on out the end of there.
Tell you, I was working a midnight job on West End, West Lee down there, out there in Biddle, and you'd leave the roundhouse, engineer and fireman, you go down to the crossing behind the yard office, pick up the switchman, and you go to the west end of the yard. They had a little shanty down there, and had a, it didn't have a electric drinking fountain. You had a jug, I mean a keg with ice water in it. Well, we got down there at the crossing, and the switchman come out there, and the one guy, now he was new, I didn't know who he was, he went to get on the footboard and slipped and fell, and I didn't think much about it. He got back on. Well, we get down to the other end of the yard, that sucker was drunk. They fired him on the mop for drinking, see? So they put him on a rack flat right in back to old around number four, you know, behind the shanty there, and told him to go to sleep, just stay out of the way. Well, in the middle of the night, they got one of the, we used to get cars of wine in here, pure wine. And they had an outfit here that bottled it. They cut it and then bottled it. Well, every time we get one in, some strange reason, it started leaking. Well, this one started leaking, and they filled up that drinking jug down there full of wine. And the next morning, you know, we got ready to tie up and come up, and that old boy woke up. Well, he was thirsty, you know. That's the first thing he thought about, was drink water. Man, we got ready to come. He's so drunk he couldn't stand up. We just went on and left him down there. I don't even remember who he was. There was a little drinking that went on.
Very little, after a while.
I was working a job at Mallory, and we went to work at 11 o'clock at night and went to Camden and came back. It was a 16-hour job. And old Shock was one of the brakemen, and Carly was the conductor. And we'd meet up here, and then we'd drive our cars to Mallory, you know. And we all met up here, right up here at Asher University, matter of fact. We stopped down there at that Blue Hill or whatever it was down there, and all went in and got some coffee, except Shock. Now, I know that good and well that when he got in his car down here, he was sober as a judge. And he didn't go in. We drank coffee, and we come back. Went down and got on the engine, and a minute Carly come up there and hollered up at me, and I said, "What's wrong?" He said, "You got to watch Shock. He's drunk." I said, "He can't be drunk." And that sucker had got drunk while we were sitting in there drinking coffee. And they just put him on a caboose, you know, and just let him stay out of the way.
We have a fireman here was, he took pride in keeping his hair set just so, you know, Charlie Norman. And so the road foreman of engines got up on the engine down there one day on the east lead. And he looked at Charlie and he chewed him out, told him to go get a haircut. And after he left, Charlie told me, he said, "You know," he said, "I spent $10 today getting my hair styled, and he wants me to get a haircut."
You know, the company was pretty strict on that when it all started about this haircutting deal, but there were several of them out there that had real long hair. And then the company found out that, well, they really can't do anything about that. So they sort of dropped it and then told him, "Well, if you're not going to get your hair cut, you're going to have to put your hair in a net." Well, a lot of them didn't like that, and I think they went ahead and got their hair cut, maybe.
Okay.
Since we're talking about eating, I'll tell you a little story about eating. These conductors and some of the brakemen, they used to take pride in cooking on the cabooses, this was a big deal, and they cook most anything. Well, on this Searcy local, they stop at Desark and go uptown and eat every day. But this conductor, and I can tell you who it was. It was Elliot.
Nubbin
Elliot. Yeah. He had cooked up a big pot of spaghetti and meatballs on the caboose, and they pulled in there at Desark to go eat. And he said he had made it up with the crew that they was going to come back there and eat on the caboose. And we had Charlie Norman was the fireman. And so they had all dropped off and gone back to the caboose, maybe four or five cars back. It was a local, you know. And they got back there and they called on the radio and said, "Charlie, come on back." Well, he got the train and started back in the train. And they said, stop. Well, he put it in emergency. When he did, the pot of spaghetti and all went out in the floor off the caboose. That was their dinner. So they had to go uptown and eat. And to add a little bit more to it, of all things Charlie ordered up there was spaghetti and meatballs. But anyway, it was something.
Oh, Nubinelli, he was, for a long time, he was a conductor on a Hot Springs local. He had a job and then went to Hot Springs, tied up, came back next day. And he tended to drink Stag beer. And he always, first stop out of town was only about a mile and a half down the road. And he always managed to stop them where the caboose was right across the road from a liquor store. George Steele, I think, did the same thing probably.
Talking about food, the Rock Island, we go into Brinkley. Brinkley, maybe we'd on duty maybe 6 or 8 hours, whatever. But anyway, if they threatened to fire us if we went to eat at Brinkley, the Cotton Belt, if they wasn't going to stop there, and you didn't have anything to do there on the Cotton Belt, their company would hand them up a sack full of groceries. We got nothing.
Had them up sack lunches.
Yeah.
Well, they'd turn in their order what they wanted.
Yeah. And when they left Pine Bluff.
And the Cotton Belt would tell them how much they could have, two sandwiches and a sweet roll or something and some kind of a drink. That was what they could have. And they had, in the little restaurant there, they would tell them what kind of sandwiches you know had. You maybe ham and cheese or egg and olive or something like that, you know, and they'd say, we want so many ham and cheese, so many this, that, and the other. And so, but that eating on the railroad was always one of our major gripes and complaints, that and being able to get enough sleep and so forth. But they've got all that settled now pretty well, I think.
I'll tell you what, though, going to work, leaving the Rock Island and going to work for the Union Pacific, was the difference between daylight and dark. They had money. They got money. And they give us watches, they give us jackets. Christmas and Thanksgiving, they passed out turkeys. They had, I was on a safety committee for Biddle, and I was fascinated. The first time we had a safety committee meeting, we went to Steak and Ale. And they had a meeting room, and we got through eating, and the assistant superintendent said, well, you can order what to eat, what you want to eat. And everybody looked at, you know, I didn't know what to spend. He said, anything on that menu you order, we'll pay for it. And we had all our safety meetings at TGI Fridays or, you know, places like that.
But I've got, I don't know, I guess 4 or 5 clocks that the Union Pacific gave me. I got 2 watches they gave me. And all kind of stuff. But Rock Island gave you exactly nothing. In fact, they had some flashlights. They were coated with rubber, insulated. And I said something one day about, well, could I get a couple of batteries? And Mr. Rich, the road foreman at the time, said, we furnished you lights, and buy your own batteries.
I don't ever remember furnishing me a flashlight.
Well, I finally got a flashlight. But the UP had this machine. They still got it over there at the Biddle Yard office, and they still got one over in North Little Rock. But they had this thing full of batteries, gloves, all kind of stuff. And you had a card, just like a vending machine. You stuck that card in there, punched buttons, and it gave, you could get a pair of gloves just almost every day.
They're good, too. They weren't cheap gloves. I've still got a pair, and I've had them for 12 years out there. I remember just before I retired, they come over to Biddle. I was working over Biddle, and they send somebody over every day to clean the engine, you know, and wipe the windows and everything. And Sam, a helper, I forget what his name, Sam something, or the real nice guy. I said, and they used this spray. I forget what to call it, but I said, how about getting me a couple of bottles of that, and I was going to bring them home, you know, after it. He brought me a whole case, and I'm using the last bottle right now. That was 12 years ago. But it was different. Of course, the Rock Island was basically always poor, but I think probably, if the truth was known, I think this hot spring, what we call a hot springs branch down here, carried the Rock Island by itself for a long time. I mean, they had places like Jones Mill, which belonged to Reynolds Metals, and there at Bauxite, where Reynolds, Alcoa had a plant. A lot of revenue came off that hot spring branch.
They had a place called Magnet Cove down there, and you could come off there with whatever you had. Usually, it's, what would they call that stuff? Sort of looked like mud.
Bayrite,
small cars, and you come downhill for about, was it 2 miles down
there? Talking about no brakes.
Well, no brakes. So you had a, if you messed up going down the first grade, you could get by with that. But when you started down the second grade, if you couldn't release your brakes, or you'd better not, because if you released those brakes, you were gone. and down at the bottom of the hill, there's several times, well, this friend of ours, Guy Winters, he'd been down on working down there, and he said, well, I don't know, said, this is the third time I've gone down. Said, the first time was a complete disaster. Said, the second time I got a little better, and said, I don't know what's going to happen this time.
I remember the first time I ran off the hill up there, Armstrong was an engineer. Wilbur Armstrong was really a good engineer. He knew his business. And he always came down at night, naturally. And we left up there. And when you left up there, you had about 12, 15 of those little old cars that didn't have any brakes on the speed. And as soon as you got moving, you set the brakes.
Yeah.
And also the engine brake. And you held them until you got to the bottom, almost to the bottom of the hill, and you released them and you went up another hill before you came down a second. Well, I was going down there, you know, and I decided I'd got to the bottom of the first hill, and I released them, and man, away we went. I mean, we were safe, scared me, and I looked over Armstrong. I turned the light on. He's sitting over just grinning. I said, I ought to kill you. And he said, why? I said, you let me release these brakes too early. He said, I bet you don't do it again. That second one, I never even come close to getting them.
Well, it's the second one that comes onto our main line down there. There was a derail on that one. And if you run through, got your brakes off too quick, you was in that derail.
Well, they always left the derail off.
Yeah,
well, they used to get on them if they caught them doing it, but they wouldn't leave it on going up that hill.
Yeah, but some of those officials come down there and wanted them to open the derail for them when they went up.
Yeah.
And that's a bad thing to do.
Yeah, somebody told them, I forget whether it was Rep Logle or who, coming down there one day and began to pick up speed, and they had to, the assistant superintendent with him. Oh, what did they call? I can't even remember his name. Long pants was too long. I don't think it was that old man's name. Anyhow, he was on there, and it was pretty obvious that they wasn't going to get stopped.
Yeah.
They didn't look like they were going to get stopped. And so he walked over behind the hog head. They had one of the alcoves, you know, and the door was behind the hog head. And he was standing there, and the hog head turned around and said, don't get in that door. He said, if we don't get stopped, you're going to get run over. What a John Cartland.
Yeah.
That was he.
Yeah.
Talk about some of the oddball locomotives you had. Didn't you have?
I'll tell you something funny about locomotives. The first General Electric locomotive they sent down here, at least the first one I was ever on, I was going west, and I got on the engine there at the roundhouse to go to West End of the Yard to get on a train, and they sounded, I mean, they sounded terrible. They always sounded terrible.
These the 200s?
Yeah.
Yeah, they did.
We got down there, and finally I decided there's something wrong with them. And I called the roundhouse, and I said, is there an electrician down here? I said, there's something wrong with his engine. And I forget who it was, sent an electrician down there, and he come up there laughing. He said, there ain't nothing wrong with his engine.
No,
like them. But boy, they were powerful. I'm telling you.
When you hooked those up with EMDs, you had a problem because they'd start flipping the wheels.
Yeah.
And those old 200s, General Electrics, that throttle looked like an axe handle.
Yeah.
And you had to notch it.
Yeah. And every notch had a half notch.
Yeah.
But you didn't have that on those EMDs, though. You'd half notch the General Electric, and they didn't do that on the Hyundai.
No, you're talking about the only really small, we had a 500, which was an EMD switch, and it was little. It was a six-cylinder engine, I think, if I'm not mistaken. And they up in Memphis a lot, but they had that thing up at Boonville. I don't even know who made that. It was really a little bitty thing. It didn't do, basically, when they had a switch engine up there, all they did was change cabooses on trains. You know, it may do a little switching around, but not much. But otherwise, we had pretty good power. Like Howard said, they let the steam engines fall apart before they all went away. But we started out with GP7s, and they got some 9s and 18s, and then they come up with some GP35s and 40s. But we had a lot of cab overs. In fact, we got a bunch of, when they went into, I guess they went into bankruptcy, before that, they got a bunch of old cab overs, what they call FTs, you know, and stuff like that, and they got them off the Union Pacific. The UP had got rid of them, and Rock Island took them, you know. And you'd have engine trouble a lot of times, but it wasn't our fault. We couldn't help it. You just call them and say, I got engine trouble, send somebody out to fix this thing.
I remember once when we first got our diesel switch engines over there in Memphis, some of these old engineers, like I said earlier in this conversation, that a lot of them didn't ever finish high school. A lot of them, I don't believe, ever got out of kindergarten the way they acted. But they got these new switch engines, diesel switch engines over there. And this old engineer, I think it was Clyde Malone, but I'm not certain. He got an oil can and went in there, and all these electrical contacts on that diesel engine, he oiled all those things. Good. Well, consequently, when they got ready to leave, that thing wouldn't move out of its tracks. And they had to send the electrician over. Well, he found out what the problem was pretty quick, you know. And they didn't do anything to the old engineer, but that was an example of how much they knew about this new equipment. And I don't blame him as much as I will the company for not instructing them.
Yeah.
They'd give you a brand new engine out there and a big long train, and you never had been on that engine before. You didn't know what the different gauges were on it, and they were different.
Uh-huh.
And they expected you to do 100%.
I run into that on a mop just before I retired. They sent me out to Higgins one day to get a brand new empty coal train, and a brand new locomotive. I mean, the UP's got some nice engines. And we took off. And you go down there close to the airport, there's a curve down, you had to brake for it. Well, when I went to brake, it dawned on me, I didn't know how to bail an engine brake off. And I went to slapping things like that, trying to get that in. Finally, I figured out how to kick it off. Buddy probably operated on it more than I did. But, you know, it's like you say, they stick you up on a brand new locomotive, and they change things up.
Yeah. David, my son's an engineer on the UP now over there. And he just come off that north end, and he said the hardest part of working up there was on those new engines. The gauges are not dial gauges like we used to have with a pointer. They're all
digital. Mm-hmm.
And they're all right in front of you. And he said it's just like sitting in a 747 looking at the instrument panel on an airplane. And the air gauges, instead of a needle, it comes out in digital, see? And we run into that on these engines, new ones that we got down here. We never got any instructions. He might hand you a book, a manual, but maybe he would.
Uh-huh.
I had to ask for every manual I got, except one. I had a real good friend on the mop at the time. Eldon Dent, you never did know him.
I know the name.
Well,
I thought you think to say Benny Jarman.
I don't knock old Benny.
No, he was good to me.
Oh, well, let's talk about Benny.
I'll talk about Benny. Benny was a section foreman. And he always wanted to be an engine man, I guess. So they hired him as an engine man.
Out of Forest City.
And he fired for me quite often. And he, you know, he was all right. I got along well. In fact, he saved our butts over way up at Waveland one day. We were fixing to run a weight or a meet up there, one or the other, and he's the only one that had sense enough to figure out we were doing wrong. He stopped me.
So, well, I had him as a student on that Hot Springs local, you know, Benny Jarman, and I was letting him run, and he was inspecting the track more than he was watching where he was going. And he said, there's a rail that's broken, or there's a wide joint there in the rail. And I told him, I said, Benny, you're not inspecting the railroad anymore. I said, just forget it. If he kept doing that, we never would get it.
Boy, he made a name for himself on the mop.
I'll tell you what he did with me on the mop now, just before I retired. They were going to run this trooper on the train, they called it, where they put some law enforcement officials on this train. They run it out of the depot south, then north. And he came over at a Bidland. He said, you want to go over and run that train? I said, Benny, I'm not on the Arkansas division. I'm technically on the Valley division. He said, I don't care. He said, do you want to do it? And I said, yeah. He said, well, you show up at such and such a time and you'll be one of the engineers. I said, okay, nobody ever said anything about it. So I guess it's all right.
Well, they didn't know about it.
I did this. He asked me if I wanted to run this train, and I said, well, sure, I'll be glad to. And I could run it out of North Little Rock up towards Van Buren. And was out there in the siding. I was on the main line, and there was a train coming down through the siding. And I looked over, and I said, well, he's not going to get stopped. And there was a red block there. And sure enough, he didn't get stopped. So they fired him right there on the spot. But I had a cab full of policemen, There was some kind of a publicity thing that they had going, and
they used to do it pretty regular once a year, I think. But,
this old boy, he knew better than that. Well, I forget now what he's John somebody, and he run right by that red block as if it was not even there. And I had the superintendent's coach with me, and I don't know what all. And if I had a clear block to leave there, and if I'd left, he'd have broadsided me.